This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. A number of high-profile incidents have made the news in the past few days, highlighting racism, hate, and violence in the age of Donald Trump. Since the Portland stabbing of three men by a white supremacist who racially targeted two young women of color, there have been reports of a white man attacking an African-American man with a machete in the midst of a racist tirade in Clear Lake, California. And two young Native members of the Quinault Indian Nation in Washington State were struck in a hit-and-run incident involving a white man driving a truck. Tribal leaders say the incident could be a hate crime. Most recently, a noose was found at the African-American History Museum in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, police killings of young black men continue. In fact, three unarmed 15-year-old boys in three different cities were gunned down by police in May alone. America is a frightening place for people of color. In Trump's America, that fear is greater than ever. My guest is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an assistant professor in the Rutgers University Department of Journalism and Media Studies and a correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Chenjerai.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the incident of the noose found at the African American History Museum. People who are obviously ignorant of our not so distant history might dismiss this as something, you know, purely symbolic. Why should it upset anybody? But what, you know, how do you view, in the age of Donald Trump, something like a noose appearing at the African American History Museum?
Well, you know, this incident reminds me of so many other incidents, you know, across the country. Even on the campus that I used to work on at Clemson University, once you had an effort to start to talk about the history of African Americans' contribution at Clemson, an effort led by Dr. Rhonda Thomas, when those symbolic markers went up, someone hung some bananas on them, and that prompted, some protests and sit-ins. So you see this almost whenever there's, particularly when there's an effort to try to foreground the history that's been hidden in this country, there's a backlash, a kind of symbolic backlash, bananas. This also happened at American University. And now here a noose, which is a particularly painful kind of symbol to use because it reminds us of the horrible history of lynching. But I think that those symbols are not purely symbols. I mean, if these symbols were happening at a time when you didn't have actual hate crimes, when you didn't have lethal poverty, when you didn't have all these other kinds of attacks and sort of racial terror, then maybe we could try to dismiss them as symbols. But in fact, that's not the case. These symbols are happening at a time when it seems like actual material racial terror is intensifying.
And of course, the noose appearing inside the African American History Museum came just a few days after a noose was found hanging outside nearby Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden. During Barack Obama's presidency, there was a lot of that imagery and symbolism that we saw in extremist elements of the right wing as well. Let's talk about the Portland stabbing. We covered that issue on our show earlier, but earlier this week. What's interesting, since we covered that, is that the alleged, that's the suspect in the case, this person named Joseph Christian, who allegedly stabbed the three men who intervened during his racist tirade, he didn't make an attempt to keep his views hidden. He had an outburst in the court where he basically said he was a patriot, not a terrorist. What do you make of this? He's quite proud of what he did, it seems.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot there to be unpacked. These racial crimes are interesting to me because often what I'm trying to do as someone who's talking about how race works and, you know, how essentially whiteness can be weaponized, I'm often trying to turn people's attention away from only thinking about, you know, the Ku Klux Klan or explicit hate crimes as the face of what we should worry about, right? Like, I wanted to think about those things as things that are horrible for sure, but to point more to ways that things are institutionalized. But, you know, we're arriving at a point where we have to take these incidents very seriously, And these people are becoming really explicit about the views, and there's a strange way that the views that they are expressing kind of connect to the things that are coming also out of the mouths of politicians. So in that context, you can't just ignore that relationship. I mean, you can try to call it anecdotal, but so many incidents and such a tremendous coherence between what they're saying and what you're hearing out of the mouth of mayors and governors and things like that. So just tremendous.
Mr. Christian, in fact, yelled, "Free speech or die, Portland. You got no safe place. This is America. Get out if you don't like free speech." It's interesting that he brought up an issue of free speech as if somehow his speech was being hampered. But does this fit with the narrative that Trump and so many Republicans have pushed over the years that political correctness is holding America back and they should be free to say whatever they want to say?
Well, it's tempting to try to dismiss. I mean, his statement looks ridiculous, right? He's attacking people, who are trying to protest what he's doing, and then he's calling it free speech. It seems ridiculous. And it's also tempting to try to reject this as deeply un-American. But I don't know that that's actually true. I think if we look accurately at the history of America, and really the history of the Western world and the Enlightenment, going back that far, what we find is that white men's freedom. The condition of white men's freedom was the death of black bodies, and the death and enslavement and exploitation of black women and all kinds of people. So that's a deep historical narrative. Like their literal freedom was based on being able to hold people as property. And there's a so I mean, I don't want to be do sloppy history here, but I think that actually it's a very American tradition. And so when you see Donald Trump coming up and saying, well, kind of like performing this type of sensibility, where he's being deeply oppressed and his freedom is being constricted by not being able to say insulting things. I mean, I think that that's consistent with an American tradition and just kind of out in the open now.
Now, for every Joseph Christian, there is a Micah Fletcher. I'm referring to the survivor, and of course, the other two men. There were three men who did step into their credit in an admirable way. Literally, I mean, they may not have realized they were putting their lives on the line, but that is indeed what happened when they stepped in to basically run interference when this man was yelling racist things at these two young women of color. And what's really interesting is the lone survivor of the stabbing, Micah Fletcher, in the midst of all of the labeling of these men as heroes, has really urged the city of Portland to pay attention to the two young women of color who were the initial target. They might have been the ones who might have been stabbed. And he said that it's important to call out the city's white savior complex. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I think that, in some sense, it's good that he's pointing this out. I mean, when you look at how much money was raised at the fundraisers from the fundraisers around this incident, and you see that for him and the people who intervened, there was all this tremendous amount of money raised. I don't know, like over $1 million or something like that, and then not as much money raised for at first for the women, young women who were attacked, one of whom was a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. You do see that. Basically, this story of white people saving brown people is a narrative that we like, and so it plays out. I mean, on the other hand, I mean, these folks did step in, and two people lost their lives, and so I think that that's important to recognize. I don't want to minimize that at all, even while we want to counter those trends.
Right. And I should also mention the two girls were extremely young. They were literally girls, not women, 16 and 17-year-old. The African-American young woman, her name is Destiny Magnum. And then her friend, a Muslim girl with a hijab, her name I don't believe has been released to the public. Her mother's name is
Right.
Joanna Hudson. The mother said that this man was the attacker, the alleged stabber was saying that Muslims should die and that Muslims have been killing Christians for years. So it's important, I think, for us to try to name, the women who were the first targets of this deranged person. Let's talk about some of the other attacks that have happened. There was the incident of the African American man in Clear Lake, California, being chased and attacked with a machete by a white man, and two two young Native kids attacked in a hit and run, one of whom died. You know, African Americans and Native Americans, I think, are the two groups of people of color in the United States that bear the brunt of the worst violence in this country, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, once again, what do you say? People's, it kind of seems like a white person who is bothered or motivated by a white supremacist group or whatever can strike out in the most flagrant ways with a machete, with a sword in New York and kill brown people. And there's no, you know, what's interesting to me is on one side of it, you have the fact that it becomes difficult actually to prosecute these people appropriately. And you have a conception like hate crimes where you try to capture this dimension. And sometimes you have trouble even proving that these things are hate crimes. That looks like it's going to become an issue in the case with the Native Americans. But there's also just a disturbing atmosphere where people are increasingly motivated and emboldened to perform these kind of acts. And, you know, that seems like really hard to kind of get a hold on. So.
Yeah, and all of that going hand in hand with the fact that we have at the head of our Justice Department a, you know, person with a documented history of racism, Jeff Sessions, who has made it clear that under his administration of the Justice Department, there will be a minimal pursuing of civil rights complaints of violations of civil rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeff Sessions is rolling these things back. And I just want to point out that these crimes, right, are happening at the same time when Donald Trump is lawyers are trying to push forward the travel ban, which was, you know, pushed on the fear of terror by Muslims.
So, Chandra, in addition to these sorts of vigilante acts of violence that we see ratcheting up and spiking under the Trump administration, the violence, the daily violence that we've seen, particularly facing African Americans, continues unabated as well. And I'm talking specifically about police violence. And I mentioned at the beginning that three 15-year-old boys were recently killed in three different cities in the month of May alone. You know, Jordan Edwards' case got some coverage, but none of them got as much coverage, say, for example, as Tamir Rice's case. And of course, it's unlikely that any of them are ever going to see any real justice, as unfortunately Tamir Rice didn't see. What do you make of these incidents? And should we be linking them to the general violence facing people of color in the U.S.?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think one concrete way that we have to link this to some of the things we've been talking about is that you have Jeff Sessions, an attorney general who, you know, is leading the Justice Department and completely rolling back all the progress that has been made by Black Lives Matter in terms of federal investigations and the sanctions that will be placed on police departments. And, you know, I think another thing is that, you know, you talk about Jordan Edwards, Jason Negrin, Darius Smith, all being killed by police. You know, one of the things that I noticed was that in each of these cases, you had situations where there was either from, you know, problems ranging from outright lies by police officers to just kind of not complete evidence. Smith. I mean, Darius Smith asking us to believe
can you
that
repeat that
a
last
young man
sentence?
Without any criminal record.
Chandra, I'm sorry, there was a little hiccup in the... go ahead.
Right, no problem. I'm just saying that what you have in each of these cases is problems ranging from outright fabrication by police officers about what had happened in the incident to just, you know, kind of sketchy evidence and missing information. So in the case, for example, of, you know, Jason Negrin, the officer said that he was shot in the head, and later upon further review, we find out that he was not shot in the head. He was shot in the hip, and the officers admitted that they left his body for 6 hours and let him bleed out. In the case of Jordan Edwards, we also had a complete fabrication about what happened. You know, officers lying, saying that they were being attacked, etc. And then in the case of Darius Smith, you have an officer claiming he was being robbed by Darius Smith, but we find out later that Darius Smith was shot while he was running away and that he had no criminal record. So, I mean, those problems are precisely the kind of things that Jeff Sessions' Justice Department should be investigating systematically, but the opposite is happening.
What goes hand in hand with the narrative of racism is the victimhood of whites. And President Trump sees himself this week as a victim of a very crass humor that comic Kathy Griffin put out there. She, you know, posted a photo of herself holding a mask of a bloodied face of Donald Trump, a Donald Trump mask that looked like it was bloodied, and that she was basically holding his decapitated head. Obviously, in extremely poor taste. What do you make of the Trump administration's response and the response of people defending Trump to this?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, like you said, this seemed like it's in poor taste. I mean, on the other hand, we rely on comedians to try to push the agenda, to try things and experiment, and art is a place where we try different things. And so on one hand, it seems like it's in poor taste once she did that. But what I find very interesting is that when the GOP uses violent language, violent imagery, we don't get any of the same pushback. We get, in fact, you know, you look at Charles Wasco, who I don't know if it was last September, came forward and was talking about Obama needing to be lynched, and had these different memes that were kind of indicating that, orangutans and all those kind of things. And upon the
response
for it,
right? Like, this is a Republican mayor.
This is a Republican mayor he's a Republican mayor of a small town here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, he never even apologized for that. He said, I did put the racist things out, and I don't care, you know, how people interpret me, you know, and he was bold. So where Kathy Griffin is apologizing and she's posting things apologizing and she, all these other things, he is bold about it. And then you have incidents like, this is not quite a hate crime, but you have Gianforte, who, if I'm correct, choke slammed a reporter according to all the accounts, and then won the special election. So
this is a Republican running for special election just a few days ago, right? He was caught on tape body slamming a Guardian newspaper reporter, I believe it was, and then went on to win the election, his election.
So where is the outcry against violence in those incidents? Yeah. You know, it just is interesting.
It was interesting to see Donald Trump Jr.'s response to the Kathy Griffin controversy. He said, this is disgusting, but not surprising. This is the left today. They consider this acceptable. Imagine a conservative did this to Obama as president. Wow, Chandra, can you imagine?
I think we can imagine, and we don't have to imagine because we can just look at the history of what happened in September when Charles Wasco called for the very same thing. And so I think,
there have been one incident after another of Republican supporters, conservatives, you know, ordinary conservatives who had the most racist language against the Obamas. I mean, you know, we of course should have sympathy for Barron Trump having to see this ghastly image of his father. But the Obama girls had endured 8 years of seeing their father and even their mother being parodied in the most racist and violent ways. And you didn't hear the Republican Party denounce that in strong enough terms.
They did not. And then when you look at the larger context of hate crimes going up, and I mean, again, I know that you have to do complex statistical maneuvers to link specifically like this language to these incidents, but it just seems like you can't completely dismiss a connection here, you know, and then especially because many of the people who are performing these crimes are picking up language that, you know, a free speech, and they're in some ways using some of the same kind of language, almost like they're picking up the call that politicians are issuing forth. Yeah. You know, politicians who have a tremendous platform, who get out here and make media that is seen by millions of people, you know, come on.
I mean, in general, it seems as though our political sphere has gotten more violent in its language. Starting with Obama, of course, we've never had an end of racism in the United States, but it really ratcheted up during the Obama administration in terms of reactions to Obama, and ratcheted up during the Trump campaign. And since his inauguration seems to have spiked even more, it's a dangerous time for political discourse in America. But Chandrai, people of color seem to be the most vulnerable group in the United States, even as demographically they are starting to edge into the biggest group, a plurality.
That's right. You know, I mean, we're rapidly and we're hitting a point when, you know, Latinos are going to be a major, you know, our majority minority. They already are in many states, and yet, you know, the protection is not there, and the atmosphere of enmity is there. I mean, I always think about this when I'm, you know, moving around. When I was moving around South Carolina, which has a tremendous Mexican population, and I would just think about, you know, there's a lot of people who are eating at Mexican restaurants and, you know, interacting with folks, but we're also voting for Trump and supporting really, really violent rhetoric and rhetoric about borders and all these other kinds of things. So it's a really interesting time, and it doesn't seem like we're moving in the right direction.
Well, Chandra, I appreciate your insight and let's hope that even in a small way, we can influence the discourse in this country in a direction that better reflects our values and our ideals. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
My guest is Chandrai Komanyika. He is an assistant professor in the Rutgers University Department of Journalism and Media Studies. And he's also a correspondent for this show. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.